This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن رب ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says the U.S. failure to give assurance about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits from the 2015 deal is the main obstacle to its revival. Syria says Israel's nuclear activities pose a major threat to regional and international security, calling for comprehensive inspections of the regime's nuclear facilities. And Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is demanding the dissolution of parliament and new national elections, saying he is not interested in negotiating with his rivals. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's UN ambassador says U.S. failure to give assurances about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits from the 2015 deal is the main obstacle to its revival. Majid Takht Ravanchi made the remark in an address to the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said the U.S. withdrawal from the deal back in May of 2018 and reimposition of unilateral sanctions prevented Iran's enjoyment of the deal's economic benefits. Iran's envoy said the country has been negotiating in goodwill with other parties to the deal to resume full implementation of the accord. Takht Ravanchi said Iran will return to full implementation when the U.S. makes the right decision. Now, since America's withdrawal, remaining parties have held several rounds of talks to try to revive the deal. Talks failed to make breakthroughs due to U.S. failure to show goodwill and its excessive demands. New round of talks is due to start in the Austrian capital. Iran's top negotiator, Ali Barghilikiani, has called on the U.S. to seize the latest opportunity. And the next round of multilateral negotiations on the 2015 Iran deal will start in hours. Earlier, we discussed this issue with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
Fuad Izzadi is professor of international studies at the University of Tehran, who joins us from Tehran. We also have Lembit Opec, former UK member of parliament, and Press TV presenter who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Fuad Izzadi, let me first start with you. So you have the news of Iran going to the talks for the revival of the JCPOA that's happening in Vienna, and just days ago you have the U.S. Imposing sanctions on Iran. From the outside looking in, it doesn't really bode well overall for that type of atmosphere for the U.S. to apply sanctions and then have the talks restarted in a sense. How do you see that approach by the U.S.?
You know, in negotiations, we have this principle of negotiating in good faith. And if you are not negotiating in good faith, you're not going to reach any agreement. That's the basic idea. And the United States has repeatedly shown that they don't negotiate in good faith. Because when you negotiate in good faith, you try to lower tensions. You try to lower rhetoric against the other side. You try to basically find a way of reducing tensions. And when you have the United States sanctioning Iranian companies or companies that work with Iran every other day, basically, you are not negotiating in good faith. So when you're dealing with a country like that, the expectations for a successful conclusion of these negotiations are quite low. Because if the United States really wanted to return to the agreement, they could do it on the first day of the Biden presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris Climate Accord. He could issue an executive order and return. Trump left the agreement using an executive order. Biden could return to the agreement on his first day of presidency by just issuing an executive order. And they have refused to do that for the last 1.5 years. And they have just wasted time. They have dragged their feet, have caused a lot of difficulties. And it's due to Iran's patience that we have a nuclear agreement. When Trump left the agreement, Iran could do the same thing, and then you would be finished with JCPOA. The reason there is a JCPOA is because of Iran.
Lepidopic, why do you think Joe Biden doesn't do that, based on what our guest there said? Sign an executive order and come back to the deal.
The reason Biden doesn't do it is because he's not running the country. But the reason his colleagues aren't doing it is because this is geopolitics at its most cynical. Iran has been quite clear that it wants to have peaceful nuclear power. Now, it's interesting because Biden also, as you've just heard, has been quite keen on the environmental agenda. And the only way you can sustain the environmental agenda in a large nation like Iran is with nuclear power. Nothing else really is as stable as that in terms of delivering the base load, as it's called. And then they turn around and they say, no, we don't want to do this, or yes, we do want to do this, but we're going to carry on punishing you with sanctions. So the simple answer to your question is this: they don't like Iran being a regional superpower. They don't like the fact that Iran has fixed the problems, many of the problems, that America itself has caused, such as Al-Qaeda and so forth. What could happen next? Well, if we had some common sense in Washington and some common sense in the United Kingdom, then we would actually restart those talks without provocation, without saber-rattling, without pointing fingers of blame at people. And we could say, let's finish what we started and nearly finished in 2015. Chances of success not very high at the moment because the United States itself is in trouble. But I do think it's possible. And as long as Iran acts as a senior and more mature partner, then there is a good chance of success.
Fuadizadi, the midterm elections are coming up, and there are two sides to that coin. One side is in the foreign policy arena. Joe Biden needs a win. On the other side, if he needs a win, he also needs the support of Israel. And, of course, we know how the lobby is so strong of Israel in the U.S. Do you think that one of the reasons behind this not moving forward is Israel?
Yes. You know, there is disagreement in Israel with regard to JCPOA. We had Senator Tim Kaine in the United States a few weeks ago in the hearing they had on Iran, remembering a trip that he had to Israel, and he was talking about the meeting he and a number of other senators had with the head of Mossad. And the head of Mossad was telling the American senators, according to Tim Kaine, that JCPOA is the best available agreement. So the head of Mossad was encouraging American senators to go back to Washington and help to reach that agreement. So these are generally people in the intelligence community and the military. And then you have the politicians like Netanyahu that for political reasons have this anti-Iran rhetoric, and they cause problems for the nuclear agreement. The problem that we have with Biden is that he says he's a Zionist in his recent trip to occupied Palestine. He said that you don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist, and he says that he has been a Zionist for many, many years. And this is causing difficulties in Iran because he's supposed to implement the agreement with Iran and be a Zionist at the same time, which could cause difficulties for the agreement. So that's why the Iranian side wants to be cautious with regard to the promises that the Americans make, because Americans are generally are people that don't keep their promises.
Final question, Limbitopic, of course, this may be a reach, but not really. And that is the fact that you have countries like Iran, like Russia, and of course China, where you have U.S. sanctions that have been applied to them amongst a host of other countries, to the point where at this point, the more time passes by, the more, especially when it comes to Russia and China, these countries are gravitating towards each other, and really it gets to a point where the sanctions are not going to be either effective or for them to work at all, especially given the political landscape that we're seeing these days. Isn't the U.S. worried that, the route that they're taking is not working? I mean, they've acknowledged the fact that maximum pressure doesn't work.
They're worried that it's not working, but they do not understand why. It turns out, as we all know, that sanctions harm the public, the general public, citizens. They don't harm the people that the sanctions are directed at. But there's a bigger point here. When you are in an empire in decline, you don't see it. And then you start lashing out, you start fighting presumed enemies. And as you've just said in your question, the greatest irony of all here is that serious, mature, old nations like Iran, like China, like Russia, have all begun to coalesce, and India, because they're seeing a perceived threat from the West. America needs to take a breath, it needs to calm down, and it needs to start extending a hand instead of waving the saber. If they do that, then there's a chance that we can have a more stable situation. But at the moment, what we're seeing is, in the United States, a nation without a leader and a country without confidence.
Thank you for that, Len Podopek, former UK Member of Parliament and Press TV presenter from London. Thank you. And Fuad Azadi, a pleasure, Professor of International Studies at the University of Tehran. Many thanks for your input. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
And welcome back, everyone. Syria says Israel's nuclear facilities pose a major threat to regional and international security and must be subjected to comprehensive inspections by the UN Nuclear Agency. Bassam Sabah made the remark while addressing the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said Israel continues to refuse to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty due to unbridled support from the U.S. and its Western allies. Sabah added that Syria offered a resolution to make West Asia a nuclear-free zone back in 2003, but it was blocked by Washington. Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Occupying entities has so far refused to either allow inspections of its nuclear facilities or sign the non-proliferation treaty. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has demanded the country's parliament be dissolved in order to pave the way to hold a new national election. Al-Sadr made the remark in a televised address calling for a peaceful process leading to what he called democratic elections after the dissolution of parliament. He said that most Iraqis are angry with the ruling class in its entirety. Sadr added that he has no interest in negotiating with his rivals. Since 5 days back, Sadr supporters have occupied parliament in protest at the nomination of Mohammed Shia al-Sudani as prime minister. According to Iraq's constitution, parliament can only be dissolved by a majority vote of lawmakers or by the prime minister after the president's approval. Sadr's bloc emerged as the biggest faction from the last elections in October, but it still fell short of a majority. He ordered his bloc's 73 lawmakers then to quit parliament in June after failing to nominate a prime minister. China slammed the U.S. actions in Taiwan as extremely dangerous after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrived on the island for a visit. The controversial visit has inflamed tensions between the superpowers. While China says that Taiwan is part of its territory, the U.S. has really irked Beijing this time. U.S. has announced the killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Afghanistan, but the timing of his killing is somewhat questionable. After all, Zawahiri had been on the run for 20 years following the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Now Washington announces his killing months after it withdrew forces from the country it had once occupied.
The United States says it has killed the al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amari, who was a employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Zawahiri's death. Zawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Zawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Imam Hussein in the eyes of Sunni thinkers. Imam Hussein's personality and movement has astounded every seeker of freedom from any creed. Many scholars and thinkers have spoken on Imam Hussein and the Epic of Ashura during the past 14 centuries. As it was said yesterday, in a few episodes we have discussed the views of Sunni scholars and intellectuals on this grand personality and his unmatched movement. Stay with us, please, for the second part of this discussion. Yesterday we spoke about Abdulrahman al-Sharqawi, the Egyptian thinker, poet and dramatist, and his views on Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Sayyid Qutb is another famous Egyptian thinker who has authored many books on Islam and Islamic figures. Sayyid Qutb was born in Asyut province in Egypt in 1906. His childhood and adolescence coincided with the prevalence of British colonialism and Western culture in this ancient country. Sayyid Qutb first was a teacher and then went to the Ministry of Education. In addition to teaching, he used to write critical articles on literary issues too. However, he was mostly interested in versifying and writing short stories and novels. Fizzalal al-Qur'an was one of the famous works of this renowned Egyptian writer. This work is an interpretation of the Holy Qur'an. It has been based mainly on the concepts of the Qur'an which deal with the notion of jihad and formation of groups against enemies. For instance, explaining verse 51 of chapter Ghafir, or Mu'min, of the Holy Qur'an, he asks, God has promised to help his prophets and the faithful in this world, while we see in history that some of the prophets and the faithful were defeated and some others were martyred. So where was this promise of help by God? Sayyid Qutb answers, people have limited the meaning of victory to what they understand with their short-sighted look, whereas victory has various forms. Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, was thrown in fire, but he didn't give up his belief and divine invitation. Is this victory or failure? No doubt, in the view of Sayyid Qutb, Abraham was at the zenith of victory, although he was inside the huge fire. Moreover, when he was saved from the fire, he was victorious again. This is an aspect of victory, and that is another aspect. Apparently, it is very far from victory, but in reality, it is very near to it. In the eyes of Sayyid Qutb, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, is among those whom God has made victorious both in this world and in the hereafter. Thus he says, Hussein, peace be upon him, with such grandeur is martyred so disastrously. Was Hussein's martyrdom a victory or failure? According to a superficial look and trivial criteria, Hussein's martyrdom was a failure, but based on great criteria, it was an absolute victory. The earth opens its wings lovingly for all martyrs. Hearts beat with martyrs and brave souls get braver with martyrdom. No martyr can be found like Hussein, whom all human beings tremble for him from the depth of their being. And hearts beat for him and get ready for sacrifice. Sayyid Qutb then writes, many martyrs wouldn't be able to help their belief and creed even if they lived 1,000 years, and they would fail to bequeath so many lofty, humane concepts in the hearts and urge thousands of humans to do great jobs by their final words which they wrote with their blood. Sayyid Qutb enjoys a special status among the thinkers and intellectuals of the 20th century in terms of the number of works on Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his impact on the audience. His stances against the United States, Zionism, the West, and the key to the victory of Muslims remind us of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. Sayyid Qutb wrote, the Americans need Islam. They need an Islam which fights communism in the Middle East, rather than the Islam which fights colonialism and despotism. They, the Americans, do not like the Islam which rules, because when Islam forms a government, it will train people who consider empowerment and negation of colonialism as obligatory. Theodore continues, mere speech and advice cannot establish God's rule on earth. Take power from usurpers and give it back to God. Make the divine law as the basis of laws and destroy man-made laws. Theodore was sentenced to death and martyred by the Egyptian regime in 1966. Having heard the court's ruling, he said, I already knew that the ruling class doesn't like me alive. I announce once again that I neither regret nor am I sad with this ruling. I'm rather happy that I'm killed in my sacred and ideal way.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
Hussein, 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 I cry for you in pain. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will discuss the expansion of bilateral ties between Iran and Bangladesh in line with the Ebrahim Raisi government's neighborhood first policy. And we shall also take a look at how the toxic wave of Islamophobia continues to haunt Indian Muslims, preventing Muslim women from securing jobs and livelihood.
The 20th ministerial meeting of the developing aid countries, which includes the Islamic Republic of Iran, was hosted by Bangladesh this week. The meeting, focusing primarily on food and energy security, tourism and trade, provided an opportunity for Tehran and Dhaka to revitalize their relations and broaden the scope of their economic and cultural cooperation. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian's discussions with Bangladeshi officials were in line with the Iranian government's policy of expanding cooperation with countries in the region.
Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian's virtual address to the D8 summit was timed well, at a time when the Ebrahim Raisi government is looking to boost relations with regional countries in line with its neighborhood first policy. Given the scope that exists between Iran and Bangladesh for expansion of cooperation in various spheres, the top Iranian diplomat used the opportunity to call for cooperation between developing countries and creation of an efficient economic system. The two countries have made strenuous efforts in recent years to take their traditional relations to a higher level. In a congratulatory message to his Bangladeshi counterpart on the country's Independence Day on March 26, President Raisi said the amicable relations between Iran and Bangladesh should be developed and deepened further. He expressed hope that the two countries will witness greater cooperation and collaboration in areas of mutual interest. While Iran and Bangladesh share time-tested cultural relations, they have also made efforts in recent years to boost their trade and economic cooperation. In July 2006, the two countries signed a preferential trade accord, but its activation was severely affected by U.S. sanctions on Iran. Iranian officials have often noted the unsatisfactory level of trade cooperation between the two sides, expressing readiness to engage deeply and sincerely.
Relations between Iran and Bangladesh go back centuries when it was still known as Bengal. However, since Bangladesh's independence in 1971, relations between the two countries have largely ebbed and flowed. From initial frostiness due to Iran's strong ties with Pakistan to Dhaka and Tehran becoming close allies, the two sides have come a long way. In recent years, with Dhaka showing particular interest in developing strategic ties with Middle Eastern nations, the attention has gradually shifted to its relationship with Iran, a key regional player.
Iran's relations with Bangladesh date back to the 14th century, when it was a sovereign state that encompassed present-day Bangladesh, the Indian state of West Bengal, and the Burmese state of Rakhine. Iranian immigrants played a key role in the Sultanate, as Persian was the official language. Over the centuries, Bengal witnessed a massive influx of Iranian scholars, lawyers, teachers, and clerics in search of employment, as well as to propagate Islam. Politically, in the early 1970s, after a few years of frostiness in bilateral ties, relations between Tehran and Dhaka improved after Iran recognized Bangladesh. Pakistan recognized the country in 1974 ahead of the second OIC summit in Lahore, which was followed by Iran and Turkey. The relations particularly improved after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. In 2007, Iran assisted Bangladesh with aid after the country was hit by Cyclone Sitter. Iran has also served as a key partner in developing Bangladeshi oil fields in the northeastern region of Sylhet. It has also offered to rebuild the country's sole state-owned oil refinery, Eastern Refinery, which was constructed in 1963 with Iran's help. In terms of bilateral trade, Iran can buy jute, ready-made garments, leather goods, tea, and agricultural products from Bangladesh, while it can export oil, natural gas, petrochemicals, plastics, and ceramics.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Bhattacharjee. journalist and author from India. He has been a foreign affairs writer for close to two decades and has reported on Bangladesh on multiple occasions. Now, Mr. Bhattacharjee, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how significant do you see Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian's virtual participation in the context of efforts by Tehran and Dhaka to revitalize their bilateral relations?
Well, you have to really put the visit in the coming context of the visit of the D8 ministerial meeting that is going to take place in Dhaka. And this is a meeting which is coming at a crucial time when the world is more or less waking up to the importance of Bangladesh as a stabilizing factor in a world where the forces of disruption are at work. So this is a very critical moment, and this is also a moment of recognition of the importance of Bangladesh, and this is a symbolic moment in the sense that Bangladesh is more or less being welcomed for the initiatives that it is taking at home, whether be in the field of connectivity or in the field of greater law and order actions against extremism and terrorism that are getting a lot of support from neighboring countries like India. So I would say that in the larger context of regional as well as global developments, I would say the visit is coming at a time when both sides may have substantial issues on the table.
Sir, as we know, Iran and Bangladesh have shared traditional cultural ties. So my question is, why have the two countries and not been able to exploit the full potential of their trade and economic cooperation?
Well, the answer to begin with is that stars previously probably were not aligned to help the two countries come closer. As you know very well, in today's world, even strictly bilateral relations are also supported and facilitated sometimes because of regional and global developments. And the two countries are coming together at a time when the world is more or less in a phase of post-pandemic recovery. And of course, you know, the world is also dealing with the post-Ukraine war disruption of commodities, which is being described as the period of commodity shock. So both Iran and Bangladesh are important players at a time when the world is going through these seismic changes. And therefore, I would say that now it appears that the stars are aligned because you have to remember that Russia is an important player in this period. And both the countries, that is Dhaka as well as Tehran, the two capitals of Iran and Bangladesh, are close partners of Russia. And you remember that the Nuruppur nuclear power reactor that Russia is building in Bangladesh is one of the largest nuclear power projects that Russia is building anywhere in the world. And this power project is likely to be completed in the next 1 and 1.5 years. So just like, you know, Iran, which has benefited from the nuclear energy of Russia, you have now Bangladesh getting on the same boat. And Bangladesh is, of course, getting on that boat because of its very, very steep energy requirement. So I would say that there is also the Russian factor, which is bringing the two sides closer. And then, of course, you know, Iran has its troubled relationship with the West, with the United States. And Sheikh Hasina's government in the last few weeks has seen several ups and downs with the Western countries that are increasing pressure on Bangladesh because of democracy, human rights, and freedom of expression. And Sheikh Hasina herself has made certain comments that have indicated that the prime minister is probably looking for new partners. And if that be the case, then perhaps I would say that truly the stars are better aligned this time to bring the two countries together.
So you think the time is right for Tehran and Dhaka to reactivate their preferential trade agreement, which has been put on the back burner due to U.S. sanctions?
Well, you have to really look at trade in the present a critical condition of the disruption that the world economy is undergoing. And I think the preferential trade agreement needs to be forward-looking, especially because it was the product of a particular age when things were very different from what it is at present. You know, the Russians were not assertive back then, and they are assertive right now. So the world's market has changed dramatically. So you'll have to really reorient it and look at the future requirements of the both sides, and then move ahead and create a preferential trade agreement that will serve both sides, rather than just going back to the trade agreement and trying to restart it in its original form. I think the two countries really need to come on board because of the energy requirement that Bangladesh at present has, because Bangladesh is going through an acute phase of energy crisis that it needs to deal with at an emergency basis. So I think Iran can help Bangladesh considerably on that front. And Bangladesh can provide some critical diplomatic support at the United Nations and in other fronts. And I think it can be a good win-win situation for both sides.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
In a tweet, Iran's foreign ministry quotes the country's top diplomat, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, telling the D8 summit in Bangladesh that economic diplomacy and closer ties with neighboring countries are two of Iran's foreign policy priorities. Salah Sedinri, a Dhaka-based economic analyst, says the organization of D8 countries today has the trade potential of $500 billion, marking a six-fold jump from 2017, when it stood at around $15 billion. Bangladeshi journalist Masood Karim notes that with a combined population of more than 1.1 billion people from eight developing economies of the Muslim world, D8 is a unique cross-regional intergovernmental organization stretching from Southeast Asia to Africa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The growing tide of Hindu nationalism and toxic Islamophobia has dangerously manifested in India under the present ruling dispensation, with a tsunami of hate speeches, attacks on religious places, desecration of religious symbols, and abuse of religious freedom. It's become an open season against Muslims in the world's largest democracy. Now, according to reports, serious obstacles have emerged in the way of Muslim women in the private sector market in India, with rampant discrimination and racism preventing them from landing jobs.
Each day brings new challenges for minority Muslims in Hindu-majority India as the country slowly slides toward Hindu-majoritarianism. Islamophobia in India enables violence, hate, subjugation, intimidation, and blatant discrimination against Muslims, who make up roughly 15% of the country's 1.35 billion population.
This Islamophobic sarkar is trying to deny our right. We want our right and freedom. And we will fight for our last minute of our life. And this is for us, and this is for our community, and this is for our all Indian citizens, citizenship right.
A recent study by Led By Foundation, a leadership incubator for India's most disadvantaged women, reveals serious impediments for Muslim women in securing jobs in the country's burgeoning private sector. The research found that for every two callbacks that a Hindu woman receives from private sector firms, a Muslim woman gets only one. According to the study, the net discrimination rate of 47.1% for Indian Muslim women compared to Hindu women proves the significant hiring bias and prejudice against Indian Muslim women across industries and geographies. The damning report reveals how the Muslim community, especially Muslim women, continues to be underrepresented in the formal job market. The report comes in the wake of calls for an economic boycott of Muslim vendors, daily wagers, craftsmen, and other service providers by fanatics associated with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. It shows that recruiters think of Muslim women as less capable of jobs that they are fully qualified for.
India's minority Muslim community has encountered decades of discrimination and racism, which has assumed alarming proportions under Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP government in the last 8 years. Under Modi, Muslims have been othered and reduced to second-class citizens. As per conservative estimates, around 80% of India's Muslim population today comprises Pasmanda, a Persian word for those left out. These people lag behind on economic, social, and political parameters with no voice, no representation, and no agency.
The Hindu nationalist BJP has been accused of not giving adequate representation to Muslims in India. Notably, the party now has no Muslim among its 395 members of parliament after the term of former minister Mukhtar Abbas Naqvi ended in early July. Lack of representation and opportunities, though, isn't limited to politics. The malaise permeates all sectors of the public and private sectors. It also isn't an issue that pertains only to men. Women have been equally dispossessed and driven out of different spheres where they have had the opportunity to excel. Muslim women have also been at the receiving end for asserting their identity and freedom of choice. They have been forced to give up hijab. They have been auctioned online. They have been denied jobs. They have been put in jails. Their houses have been bulldozed. Yet they have stood firm and refused to be bullied or intimidated. The lack of representation in the job sector, as revealed by the Led By Foundation study, is another eye-opener. It says the overall participation of Muslims in union government departments is abysmally low at all levels. It also adds that the unemployment of Muslims in universities, banks, and public sector undertakings is also low.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mrs. Mirali, the editor of the Longview magazine from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Mirali. Now, according to a report, serious impediments have been created for Muslim women in India in securing public and private sector jobs. Now, do you see it as part of a toxic wave of Islamophobia and racism?
There are really long-standing problems in India with regard to, amongst other things, gender issues and the treatment of minorities. And what we see here is the continued coalescence of the two with regard to Muslim women. So, yes, there is definitely a toxic wave of Islamophobia, a very strong vein of it, current of it, running through India at the moment. But this is not particularly a recent thing. So it's part and parcel of it, but there are many other aspects to it. And I would say, arguably, that this is has got much longer and deeper roots.
Mr. Mirali, now under the Narendra Modi government in India, Muslims have been othered and virtually left out of the system. So could we say that this has damaged the country's rich secular democratic fabric?
So I have some issues with the framing of India as having a rich secular democratic fabric. I know this is a great idea that's been promoted for a long time, but really, as we've discussed before and in other places, there have been a lot of deep-rooted problems, communitarian problems, sectarian problems, problems of racism, and of which Islamophobia is just one, in India since partition, since independence, that have never been looked at, that have just simply been allowed to ossify at the social level and are completely embedded within the structures and systems of the Indian state. So, yes, there has been more damage under the BJP, but the BJP themselves are an outcome of this system. You know, they're not something that ran counter to it. They're very much a product of it. And until we really disentangle this, until people within India and outside of India start really discussing some of these problems, which are in some ways not even just India specific, they are to do with the post-colonial settlements around the world, particularly from the British Empire, but not only that, we're not going to get progress. We're going to keep seeing repeat cycles of extreme violence, extreme racism, extreme Islamophobia, and then a normalization settling down of some lower levels of discrimination, Islamophobia, and then another spike, and so on and so forth.
Basmala Lismis, how has India changed over the past 8 years of the BJP government, and where do you see the country 10 years down the line?
You get now very openly, blatantly discriminatory laws and policies. I think this is one of the key differences. Whereas before, you may have more subtle forms of exclusion and marginalization and otherization. And I use the word subtle in inverted commas. What you now have is a kind of blatant call to aggression against Muslims. So you will see that high-ranking politicians, people within those networks of the BJP, and to be honest, even other political parties kind of in their wider networks, are being caught out, making extraordinarily violent speeches, claims against Muslims. You have endless conversations now trending about the justifications of cracking down on Muslims, discriminating against Muslims, even killing Muslims because on XYZ spurious basis, you know, things like fictions like Love Jihad, where there's a claim that Muslim men are going around seducing Hindu women and getting them converted to Islam. And these kind of what you can only describe as ridiculous narratives, which are then being used to justify these attitudinal changes in society, which again then means that more laws can be changed, more policies can be enacted. And what you have is then a distraction from the big problems that face India, the kind of increasing issues around wealth redistribution, about the way it has industrialized and the economy has grown in some ways, but then still left people in abject poverty, the decimation of the agriculture sector, etc. And none of these are being looked at. So what we get now is a kind of catastrophic collapse within India of both the economic and social fabric. This is very much kind of accelerated under the BJP, but at the same time has been masked by these kind of very rabid rhetorics and narratives. I don't want to be prophesying any kind of doom and gloom. I'm a believer and I pray and I hope that things in 10 years' time will be for the better.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Mirali for her precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
The Bridge Initiative, a project to counter Islamophobia at Georgetown University, asserts that Islamophobia in India has corroded what was once the world's largest democracy, with laws that once belonged to South Africa's apartheid now popping up across the South Asian country. Samiullah Khan, a journalist and human rights activist, cites the mob lynching case of an 18-year-old Muslim youth who was killed by extremist Hindus in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to stress that the tide of Islamophobia is rising in India. Law professor and author Khaled Beydoun says Hindutva leaders are paying women to frame Muslim businessmen in rape cases, targeting prominent business and community leaders, calling it another vile dimension of Islamophobia in India.
And that was our episode about Iran's growing ties with Bangladesh and the grave problem of Islamophobia in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
A number of Donald Trump's supporters have turned on the former president after he endorsed Tudor Dixon to become the next governor of Michigan. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Ewan Palmer. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Donald Trump slammed by MAGA supporters after Tudor Dixon endorsement. number of Donald Trump's supporters have turned on the former president after he endorsed Tudor Dixon to become the next governor of Michigan. Donald Trump announced on Friday night, 29th of July, that he will be backing Tudor Dixon, a former political commentator who backs the false claims the 2020 election was rigged in the GOP primary on Tuesday, 2nd of August. The winner of Tuesday's race will go up against Governor Gretchen Whitmer in November's midterm elections. In a statement announcing his endorsement, Donald Trump described Tudor Dixon as a conservative warrior who will stand up to the radical left as they try to indoctrinate our children and is ready to take on one of the worst governors in the nation. However, a number of MAGA supporters have reacted negatively to Donald Trump's backing of Tudor Dixon, believing that she's an establishment candidate, while pointing to the huge support and funding that she has received from Donald Trump's former Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, who resigned from her role just one day after the 6th of January riot in the Capitol. Trump supporters, irate at the endorsement, which had been rumored to arrive for months, also accused Tudor Dixon of being a Republican in name only, a rhino. In the comments underneath Donald Trump's announcement of his Dixon endorsement, Truth Social user Liberty Polty wrote, "Bad move, Trump. Lost my vote in 2024. A rhino supporter." A second Truth Social user added, "He lost mine and my family. She's a DeVos-funded establishment rhino and he just supported it. I'm out. Thousands of Michiganders I know are doing the same." The DeVos family is one of the biggest and most influential